questions before we press on?
Maybe following up on your earlier remark that you went from the viewpoint which got these discussions, because it seems that especially in this section where a content will have strong problems, because as you outlined it, it seems that in the beginning there's the attempt to establish something about self-centeredness or dependence on how everyone comes. So it seems to be, in a sense, an instrumental argument to go through these different steps and show how it doesn't work to once come to something like mutuality. So mutuality is then justified by way of striving towards independence, and it's just that the content already has much someone with a strong problem. So I think
what's the way have a problem?
Because it seems that mutuality has some unconditional request for authority and wants to growing out of the tendency self.
Well, the answer is not yet. I mean, mutualism is so far. If we have Bilgung as independence, we don't have anything that tells us we need mutuality for it. What the slave needs, and I want to make clear, what the slave wants is to be independent like the master. That's what the slave is striving for, still. The slave hasn't got this idea of communism or socialism or... You know, the slave hasn't read any Axelkind yet, so it's not wanting mutuality and justice and reciprocity. No, it wants mastery. And it turns out that searching for freedom will require us coming up with ideas of mutuality. But mutuality is not there yet.
But the initial starting point is the search for individual self-standing freedom.
And yes.
That seems to be where at least one version of Kantianism would have a struggle with that definition of freedom as self-standingness and not as universality within confined.
But I should hope so, because what I've been arguing or urging is ideas are not shot from a cannon. That's Hegel's objection to Kant. Where do Kant's universals come from? Where do categories come from? Where does all this come from? So what we want to see, and this is why I keep talking about building in history, what we want to see that universality is not a given. It's not an obvious idea. It's not born with us, as Levinas supposes. No. It's actually a very late, complicated human accomplishment, and which for Hegel is going to require a lot of Christianity, a lot of Greek culture, and a whole complicated of history. So universality is, I want to say, no, that's fine. I'm glad not to have universality, because I want to earn it. So the nice thing is we can understand from the idea of primitive narcissism, of desire, the notion of independence. Independence doesn't yet represent full-fledged self-determining autonomy, although the idea of that's beginning to flicker through in the idea of the master. Right? Because now we know what freedom means freedom from the authority of nature, and that turns out to be something like self-determination, but not quite self-determination, because we're in this complicated social relation. So all these things, so I'm saying freedom, reciprocity, universality, none of them are there yet. And that's good. That seems to be Hegel's genius, is he doesn't help himself to all the big ideas. He wants to see them emerge as a consequence of a process. So yeah, I mean, that's right. And the way I intentionally, that's why I brought up Kant at the beginning. And said something about the moral law having something like this power of stunning desire. But, you know, what does Kant have to do to earn it? The fact of reason. Yeah, well, if there's a fact of reason, everything's Jim Dandy. But there isn't a fact of reason, right? You know, there's the state of nature. There are, you know, narcissistic children.
Yeah.
We learn this stuff. So say, yeah, I want to really take seriously the idea of history, human history, as formative of our fundamental desire. And the notion of discipline here, like the way discipline works in Nietzsche, it creates, you know, a lot of eons to make an animal who's capable of keeping promises. Not to take it for granted, but to kind of earn it. Yeah.
You repeat, you said toward the end that the master starts to see the necessity. He wants what the slave wants. But you said at one point, the master too wants what the slave wants. Why does that? I know why the slave wants what the master wants. Why does the opposite thing?
Because the master says something like, I want a comfortable palace. And, you know, the slave says, okay, master, give me something you're comfortable. Well, not so sure, you know. And then the slave begins to sketch out, you know, he's an architect, so, or she's an architect. And the master says, yeah, I want that. I want the pyramid, you know, so the master begins to have to adjust his or her ideas of what it means to satisfy these given desires through what the slave can produce or what is possible, or what is offered. So the idea becomes that there's got to be this coordination of their points of view. Otherwise, the slave can't satisfy the master.
Because the slave has the knowledge and the experience.
Exactly. The slave got the news. Yeah?
More of a clarification. How do we get the split between the notion of life as such, becoming life in the natural sense, and then the spiritual notion of life, same with death? Because, I mean, it seems like the initial encounter between myself and another as an acknowledgement of another I presupposes that life and spiritual life will be one. And in the sort of the encounter, it seems like it's separate. And that's how one person can relinquish spiritual life in order to preserve life, in order to experience a spiritual death, but still be living.
Right.
And I'm just trying to figure out what's the motor for the split that allows sort of the rest of the story to continue.
Oh, why there are these two attitudes?
Well, more to the point, how do we justify the fact of two attitudes?
Kojève says, and I tend to agree with him. I mean, Hegel doesn't. Hegel and Kojève says it is simply necessary that there be these two fundamental attitudes. So Hegel has no explanation. My explanation is put it back into a developmental setting.
But a developmental setting by itself is not going to be something nor history. Right? Because, I mean, a chimpanzee still has a development. You need
a human developmental sequence. You need the authority of parents over children. You need the authority of the child's desire to become the father or the mother. So you need, internally to that, I think we can begin to see why that is, that we begin incapacitated, seems to me, essential to making the kind of story work. So I do see there's an argument in a book by Osborne. Why am I forgetting his first name? Peter Osborne, on time, where he
rightly argues that, you know, he really makes an argument for psychoanalytic theory. And he goes through kind of versions of Freud, Lacan, Kristeva, and Laplanche, in terms of his favorite, as working out the details of the master-slave thought. So, but for Hegel, I think there is no ultimate explanation for the twofold. It's just that's what's necessary to end the battle. That's that means, so he has a reductio answer, that's all. Simply logical. Nothing else will end the battle.
As characterized earlier in paragraph 194, can be sort of fully contained within an account of the relationship of two subjects, the master subject and the slave subject. Because it seems as though, certainly in Heidegger, but also in the description of pure negativity in paragraph 194, that the experience of absolute fear, the absolute lord, and seized with dread, is something precisely to the extent that it can't be a fear of anything particular.
Absolutely.
But has to be a more generalizable, so something closer to terror, basically. Yeah. So to what extent can that fear... So my general point would be that the fear of death the slave, that sets the slave into the social could not itself be an instance of sociality.
No, it's not.
Yeah. Okay.
No, what sets it into sociality is just the idea of the no-win situation of the struggle. Right? Once in sociality, he's faced with the master, who is the permanent absolute fear. So no. It's that's the whole idea that the struggle itself is indeterminate, right? And its meaning is only realized in the context of the institution of the master and slave.
So, but then how does that, not so, sort of returning to the question that came up here earlier, how does that not then, it seemed as though earlier you were suggesting that this had to be imagined as grounded in a kind of conflict that takes place between two subjects. But if you say that this encounter with an absolute fear and, you know, everything solid and stable has been shaken to its foundations is not social or not is not relational but sort of non-relational experience, an experience of solitude at its sort of core moment or originary moment, then it seems that even if it's sort of inevitably or irremediably related to this later moment of socialization, the sort of first instance, it seems as though it would have to be sort of imagined differently.
I'm not sure why. I'm not following. Because, again, what happens is I'm in the battle, and I begin to realize, if I'm the person who's going to become the slave, that this guy is going to kill me. And I'm not going to get what I want, and I'm not going to get what I want if I die, so I need to live. So I am literally frightened to death, absolutely, by the battle. That lets me put my neck out and say, you know, I surrender, which I think of as a life-saving mechanism, not realizing that in doing that, I'm actually going to enter into a structure where that fear of death is actually going to haunt me permanently in that structure. And it's the So it's a kind of no-win situation. I can die or become a slave. That's part of the answer to that earlier question. Necessity. There just no other options. So, if it draws me into a being for self, to a moment of solitude, Hegel's not denying there is a radical independence. Remember what I said? Absolute independence and absolute connectedness. That's the structure I'm going for. So yeah, there is a moment of absolute independence. And indeed, when I die, we die and I die. You know what I mean? We die our own death.
Mm-hmm. I mean, presumably, the difference between spiritual death and natural death is one inside the literal or symbolic. Right?
Yes.
They're fundamentally the same thing worked out from different perspectives.
Well, no, they're different. It's different being slave than being dead.
Once I enter into the slave.
No, I mean, that's what Derrida hates about this. It's how he's going to hate about it. They're really different. I mean, this is why the notion of soul death, Orlando Patterson's great work on this, his account of American slavery in terms of soul death. This is about how a community can be truly traumatized as a community. But that is not literal death. It really is spiritual death.
The point that I wanted to make was that they're both non-relational. If I'm dead, I'm incapable of any kind of relationality. If I'm spiritually dead, as a thing, I no longer relate, but I'm related to.
I have to relate because what makes me spiritual dead is I take on the other's view of my worthlessness. That's what's so, right? So think about what it is to be utterly demeaned, right? Is in that moment when you look at as nothing, you're taking in that nothingness. No, it is relational. That's what's terrifying about it. That the other's got you. It is the terror, that it is relational. If it wasn't relational, we could just walk away. But if he's got me, then I don't even realize I can just walk away. One of the things that people always ask political philosophers, those are the structures, why don't people rebel? Why are people throughout history, over and over again, passive? Why do they take on such? And of course, there are some instrumental things, people have necessities, but there is something about this structure that I really do think this captures a deep structure of how we can internalize the other's view of our worthlessness and live it. I do think it's religion. That's the hard thing of it. And it's also, the reason that this is why I think both Orlando Patterson and people like Butler and Benjamin try to think of problems of race and gender, histories of sexuality, using this structure. Because it's trying to understand how whole collections of people in different ways have, through long epochs of history, accepted subordination of various kinds, including absolutely, gross domination. And it's not mere force, clearly. So Hegel's digging at, or trying to dig at, those structures in which we internalize as a necessary condition for our self-understanding others' views of us. And he thinks this particular structure, he thinks, just tracks throughout history in various ways. And we're going to see there are versions of it. Stoicism, skepticism, and happy consciousness that themselves are permanent parts of the repertoire of human self-understanding. That's my hunch. That's my hunch. That's why, you know, amongst feminist theorists, I'm a kind of Beauvoirian. Why in race theories, I like Orlando Padden, you know, all the good examples. They seem to me to capture things that other accounts can't quite do. But that's and there may be further problems. We'll talk about that next semester when we do the Antigone. A lot of these problems come out there. Questions? Okay, let's do a fast Vitae Daily Doc. And then after Thanksgiving, there is no class next week. So if you come, you'll be lonely. Let me do this. First of all, the last thing, as you'll see, I want to do is refute Derrida or Bataille. I don't think that's a way of taking on really serious criticisms or handling them or worrying about them in an adequate way. For reasons I'll come to in a moment, I'm going to look at Derrida more than Bataille. Doing Bataille would take a lot longer and more complicated analysis. The reason why that's the case is that much, if not everything in Bataille, is based on him believing Kojève, believing that Kojève argues that at the end of the Hegelian story, history comes to an end. History stops. There are no further sets of fundamental human ideas about what it is to be human that are ever going to occur. It's done. It's finished. It's over. And this thought of Kojève's, that history is fundamentally over, Hegel got it right, there's no more experience, nothing further is ever going to happen. Hence, there could no longer be significant negative action, action that truly negates and therefore no more buildable. And this, again, is repeated, as most of you know, in Francis Fukuyama's The End of History, which is how we got into Iraq. That's another story, another class. Worth following out. That Wolfowitz bought this line, bought the Fukuyama line, and thought that the Iraq strategy belonged to that. So this stuff keeps going. But Bataille is thrown by this. And therefore, for him, and so, I mean, and to get an idea of how radical this is for Persia, there's a famous footnote on pages 159 to 161. It's an endless footnote, pages footnote, where Persia's wondering, if history ends, what do we do? And he assumes we don't make war in Iraq, although he probably would have supported it. What is life after history like? And his answer is, he said, I figured out what it was on a visit to Japan. It's like a Japanese tea ceremony. That is ritual behavior, done for ritual reason in a way that is perfectly satisfying. So post-historical Japanese civilization, undertook ways, he assumes that Japan is post-historical, undertook ways diametrically opposed to the American way. No doubt there were no longer in Japan any religion, morals, or politics in the European or historical sense of these words. But snobbery, in its pure form, created disciplines negating the natural or animal, given which an effectiveness far surpassed those that arose in Japan or elsewhere from historical action, that is, from warlike and revolutionary fights, or from forced work. To be sure, the peaks, equally nowhere else, of specifically Japanese snobbery, the no theater, the ceremony of tea, the art of bouquet and flowers, were and still remain the exclusive prerogative of the nobles and the rich, but in spite of this persistent economic and political inequalities, all Japanese, without exception, are currently in a position to live in according to totally formalized values. Poor Bitai goes, Oive! I want life! I want experience! I don't want a tea ceremony! So Bitai, and lots of other people who went, you know, were just horrified by this thought of the end of history. It made our life seem small and formal and ritual and empty. And therefore, the notion of pure excess, the experience of non-meaning, the notion of jouissance, all these Bataillon ideas are trying to recuperate a notion of experience after the notion of historical experience has ended. That's what they're about. Now, the reason I'm not going to address them directly is that they could not be more anti-Hegelian, the thought of the end of history. Hegel says, at the beginning of the phenomenology, in the preface which we have not read, paragraph 11, besides, it is not difficult to see that art is a birth comet, a period of transition to a new era. Spirit has broken with the world that is hitherto inhabited and imagined, and is of a mind to submerge it in the path in the labor of its own transformation, etc., etc. And then he says, you know, the gradual crumbling that left unaltered the face of the whole is cut short by a sunburst, which in one flash illuminates the features of the new world. Hegel thinks there has not yet been human history. That all history has been prehistory, because all history has been done without human freedom. So we do not yet know what it would be to live historically, that is, to live as truly self-determining beings in self-determining states. So far be it from Hegel to think that history is over, he's trying to argue that prehistory is coming to an end, and we might yet be lucky enough to live historically. But he doesn't know what that's going to be. And he does point to America. Right? You know, they'll figure out what history is over there. So this anxiety about the end of history, we will come back to it, because we're going to talk about absolute knowing, but at least it's problematic. It certainly doesn't mean quite what Bataille thought it meant. That's all I want to say about that. Nonetheless, of course, Derrida can collude in the ideas of the dualisms between philosophy and non-philosophy, of meaning and excess, of work completed versus jouissance, all these ideas. Because for Derrida, these terms can all talk or address the idea of the closure of metaphysics. And the problem of modernity as presence. Hence, what Derrida does with Bataille is try to show that Bataille notions operate a deconstruction in the precise Derridean sense of the Hegelian totality. Well, what do I mean by that? Structure is the problem for Derrida. This one right here. Why? He says that in the struggle for life and death, Hegel says that the combatants both learn, have to learn, that biological life, biological death, would be empty and meaningless. It doesn't give the slave to be, or the master to be, what they want. So Hegel, I'm quoting Derrida now, calls this mute and non-productive death, the one that happens before the introduction of spiritual life and death, Hegel called this mute and non-productive death, this death pure and simple, abstract negativity, in opposition to the negation characteristic of consciousness, which cancels in such a way that it preserves and maintains what is sublated, and thereby survives its being sublated. In this experience, self-consciousness becomes aware that life is essential to it as pure self-consciousness. Next sentence from Derrida. Burst of laughter from Bataille. Well, none of you laughed when you read that, but Bataille did. Why? Through a ruse of life, that is, of reason, life has thus stayed alive. Another concept of life has surreptitiously, spiritual life, another concept of life has surreptitiously put in its place to remain there, never to be exceeded, any more than reason is ever exceeded. So the problem of natural death is simply put aside, and we begin to worry about spiritual death and spiritual life. And this life is not natural life, the biological existence put at stake in lordship, but an essential life that is welded to the first one, holding it back, making it work for the constitution of self-consciousness, truth, and meaning. Such is the truth of life. Through this recourse to Aufhebung, to sublation. So natural life is preserved and sublated in spiritual life, and spiritual death, natural death, is preserved and sublated in spiritual death. He says these conserve the stakes, remain in control of the play, limiting it, elaborating it by giving it form and meaning. Sublation makes death mean. That's what Derrida is worried about. That's what Bataille is worried about. Sublation makes death mean. This economy of life restricts itself to conservation, circulation, and self-reproduction as the reproduction of meaning. Henceforth, everything covered by the name lordship collapses into comedy. So the problem here is once, so the argument is once you buy this story about life and death is a spiritual life and death, then there's nothing outside of the Hegelian machine. If Hegel can make death into spiritual death and life into spiritual life, then he's got everything working so that it can mean something for something else. And that's what he means by a restricted economy. A closed system. Hence, Derrida says, laughter alone exceeds dialectics and the dialectician. It bursts out only on the basis of an absolute renunciation of meaning, an absolute risking of death, what Hegel calls abstract negativity. A negativity that never takes place. Notice this is pure Derrida, because he's worried. Oh, Derrida, all deconstruction is a deconstruction of Husserlian phenomenology. Derrida only has one interlocutor, that's Husserl. Hence, when he says the next sentence, you get the moment he's criticizing, which is always Husserl, because he thinks Husserl is really is the last philosopher. I can explain why, but I'll take another course. He says, absolute risking of death. What Hegel calls abstract negativity, a negativity that never takes place, that never presents itself, because in doing so it would start to work again. So it's the idea that if something phenomenologically shows itself, then we can always recruit it. So whatever it is that's excessive can never be presented. So what is the outside must be what never achieves actual presence, what evades grasp. Hence, he says, there, for the Hegelian idea, there must be meaning, that nothing must be definitely lost in death, and further, that death, natural death, should receive the significance of abstract negativity. So by calling natural death abstract negativity, Hegel's already got a category for it. He's already recruited it. He's already given it meaning. It's the abstract, uninteresting form of death, as opposed to the... So he's already making it work. That a work must always be possible, which, because it defers enjoyment, confers meaning, seriousness, and truth on putting at stake. Hence, the opposition here to this, what he calls on page 259 the blind spot of Hegelianism, is that what you have? What pages did I give you?
236 and 257.
I gave you 256. Okay, so I. So let me go back to 257 since you had it. On the rest of 257 is going to give you the structure of restricted and general economy. Absolute comicalness is the anguish experienced when confronted by an expenditure on lost funds, by the absolute sacrifice of meaning, the sacrifice without return and without reserves. The notion of Aufhebung, the speculative concept par excellence, says Hegel, is laughable in that it signifies the busying of discourse, losing its breath as it reappropriates all negativity for itself, as it works the putting at stake into an investment, as it amortizes absolute expenditure, and as it gives meaning to death, thereby simultaneously blinding itself to the baselessness of the non-meaning. Yes, non-meaning. Which is the basis of meaning is drawn, and which this basis of meaning is exhausted. So he's claiming that there cannot be this system, right? without an exteriority that it does not acknowledge. So the notion here of
death
is a notion of difference. Laughter is a notion of difference. The blind spot of Hegelianism, he says, and I'll talk about it, around which can be organized the representation of meaning, is the point at which destruction, suppression, death, and sacrifice constitute so irreversible an expenditure, giving out without return, an absolute expenditure. This is the idea of a general economy, not a restricted economy, because you invest and you get nothing back at all. Nothing. Right? So radical a negativity. Here we would have to say an expenditure and a negativity without reserve, that they can no longer be determined as negativity in the process of a system. Well, might we say yes and no? Let me say why no, and then I'll say something about yes. I'll leave it at that. Of course, at the level of content, nothing in Hegel requires, I'd want to argue, or demands or even makes possible the thought that there cannot be absolute laws. The claim that there cannot be absolute laws seems to me groundless. And I'll come back to that thought. What is true, methodologically, is that the text exhibits, and I want to be clear what the text is doing. What the text exhibits are just those moments of actuality that have been formative and hence, by definition, have been invested in. Right? Hence, by definition, those moments that we have indeed profited by. So that's what the text is interested in, is actually just examining those moments, all of them, that we've learned something from, that do mean something to us. This is not a book about everything. It's a book, a narrow book, that looks at those moments through which we have learned who we are and how we become who we are. Now, in this fact, there is no necessity of progress. There is no necessity of progress. Although there is, he thinks, the fact of progress. It need not have happened, but it has, he thinks, and he thinks he understands what that progress is. Progress of freedom, we'll find out. But, to give you a kind of contrast, there is no necessity in and of itself that we had to learn something fundamental from the terror of the French Revolution. And this is going to be one of those points in the text where we'll argue about this whole question of having the terror and then learning from it. It's a puzzling experience. But Hegel thinks that we cannot make sense of the last movements of Western society unless not only the French Revolution but the terror have significance for us, that they actually do mean something. Namely, we did learn, and what we learn matters to who we are because we learn that the demand for freedom cannot be satisfied immediately. That is, the idea of perfect freedom or ideal freedom is an impossible idea, which is how he understands the Terra. Terra is the purity of the desire for freedom. And therefore, it forces us to think about mediation. But there have been genocides from which we've learned nothing. I cannot think of anything that's been learned from Rwanda. And there's a wonderful argument by Jeffrey Alexander trying to think of various large traumatic experiences that the rape of Nanking has been strangely unfecund in any social response. Just looks like a slaughter that is historically meaningless. What could happen? So, the statement of factuality, progress has happened, entails something about Hegel's method. And this is what I want to kind of think about. Hegel's journeying subject at every stage of experience takes some configuration of reality, some form of consciousness, to be absolute, only to discover that that defining configuration excludes something important. And as we've seen over and over again, whatever is excluded by a form of consciousness returns. There's always a return of the repressed. So that we called that earlier the causality of fate, right? Set up a structure, it has an exclusionary character, whatever you exclude reverberates on the structure and undermines it, comes to haunt you. And that can occur tragically or comically. I'm not going to have time to do comedy, but I take the unhappy consciousness to be absolute comedy. So I think it's an hysterical section. You will read it and wonder about my sense of humor. But Hegel's really trying to be, I think, comical there. He finds it funny. But he finds asceticism funny, since I mean, that is sense. But anyway. Okay, but what all this entails is that methodologically, the journeying consciousness is continually forfeiting itself and discovering its exteriority, something that it is in relationship to, that it could not acknowledge. And I want to put it that way because I want to say that that's what this book is about, that self-consciousness is continually discovering its exteriority. I mean, here in our argument, I'm suggesting, no, there's really an exteriority. And we're going to try to deny it, and it's going to come back and kick us in the ass. And this happens over and over again. So it seems to me this book is exactly about dependence and exteriority. And I take whatever deconstruction means, it means to capture a moment of absolute exteriority. That's why he's against closure, right? He wants what Derrida wants. Misread Derrida. Derrida wants world. He wants the touch of the world, and for philosophy not to think it can simply corral it, but philosophy has to acknowledge its dependence on world, its exteriority to itself, philosophy's exteriority to itself. Right? That's what Derrida is fundamentally concerned with. A kind of moment of impossible realism. That's what difference is for Derrida. That's what the laughter is. That's what the death is. moments of absolute exteriority that are not given their place or meaning by the system, but we only can have system in relationship to them. Right? That's Derrida's thought. That's the thought of deconstruction. And I'm suggesting that that's also part of Hegel's thought, which I think Derrida knew. But here's the thing. If exteriority is... if an exteriority were not my exteriority, exteriority in relationship to me, it could not mean anything. So, on the one hand, I want to say, in this respect, every form of consciousness undergoes a kind of deconstruction. That's what you may say the phenomenology is, a series of deconstruction of forms of consciousness in which consciousness bumps up against another it cannot assimilate. Of course, at that moment, another form of consciousness arises that then assimilates that other moment and puts it to work. But this is not, transparently at least, trying to assimilate the other to the identical, to the same, to presence. Because in order to assimilate what is other, the self must undo previous formations and acknowledge, and that's the trick, to acknowledge exteriority. So each sublation, you might say, is both appropriation and expenditure at once. At which point Derrida will explode. I've had the argument with him. He did explode. I never convinced him. He will say the whole process surely is for the sake of appropriation. And expenditure is always subordinate to it. At which point, I don't want to try to answer him. I want to make two comments. First, the final word in the phenomenology is not totality, but infinity. Secondly, in a fascinating essay, commenting on an essay by Joe Flay, criticizing Derrida. Judy Butler, the very last passage, says the following. She says, if dialectics suppresses laughter, could it be that laughter catches its breath, as it were, in a moment of necessary self-conservation? What kind of exhalation indeed, psyche, is this that frees itself from temporal determinacy? So she's asking the question, what would be a moment, this moment of exteriority, that lacked temporal determinacy? I wonder, she goes on to say, whether the self-consciousness that seeks to risk its life at the outset of the master-slave dialectic does not represent the project of total and unrecoverable expenditure that Bataille seeks, and whether a phenomenological narrative would not reveal that self-sacrificial laughter is one subject to its own ironic reversal. Perhaps she concludes, skipping a lot. He can only laugh while risking his life in a total expenditure because he has not yet learned the key Hegelian lesson about life, namely that it requires continued and determinate form. So the question that Butler is asking is whether the notion of total expenditure makes sense without some notion of form, even to be non-present. Yeah?
What is that essay?
It's on your readings.
Okay.
These things are all on your readings.
The subjection.
No, it's a response to Joseph Flay on Flay wants you to go to the I want to bring you to this. I'll end with this. The last page but one of Derrida's essay, because Derrida, after following Bataille through and saying, "Oh yeah, you know, Bataille operates the deconstruction of Hegel," blah blah blah, and says, "Wait a minute. How does Bataille do that?" And then he says, this is page 275, he says, Bataille thus can only use the empty form of the Aufhebung in an analogical fashion in order to designate, as was never done before, the transgressive relationship which links the world of meaning to the world of non-meaning. Now, what Derrida's saying here is that the time must give form to this. And therefore, for those of you who think about what Derrida does in Violence and Metaphysics, same move, right? He says, sure, you know, Levinas, the absolute other, all that, anti-Hegel. And then he says, wait a minute, you can't have an anti-Hegel without an alter ego. So Derrida never, as it were, thinks that these moments of exteriority are moments of absolute exteriority. They are moments of, they form a kind of critical reminder about what exteriority is and what meaning is and about what dependence is. Now, if that's what he's doing, then are we that clear or that sure he's actually doing anything different than Hegel? Have a nice Thanksgiving. We will begin with Stoicism, Skepticism, and the Unhappy Consciousness. And remember, when you read it, it's funny. Can't really say that, can you? Can't say it. Remember, it's funny.